All right, we're ready for Matthew chapters 10 and 11. And as I said, the questions for next time, we'll get those maybe by tonight and have them available. I apologize for leaving them at home. All right, we are looking right now at the ministries of Jesus, and then we plug Matthew into that to see how that fits, and we are in the Galilean ministry, and that's where we will be to the 18th chapter. We've looked at the early Judean ministry briefly, and then we have the bulk of the book given to the Galilean ministry, and that's where he is, and we'll see references to Galilee in our study in chapter 11, 10 and 11. This is our outline that we're following by J. Sidlow Baxter, and again, we are in the Galilean ministry. We're in this section concerning the things that he wrought, the miracles that he did, and we'll see some of that spill over into chapter 10, but sending forth the apostles that they might work miracles, and then we're going to see the reaction of the people, what the people thought, starting in chapter 11, and that'll carry us through chapter 18. So we'll be there for a little bit. Let's review where we've been in our chapters. Chapter 1 dealt with genealogy and the birth of Jesus. Very good. Chapter 2, visit of the wise men and the massacre of the children. Chapter 3, all right, very good. Yeah, John the Baptist and the baptism of Christ. Chapter 4, all right, heard somebody say temptation of Jesus, and then that's the beginning. It's a good place to remember of the Galilean ministry. Very good. So this is where the Galilean ministry begins. It will not end till the 18th chapter. So that's a good section, a bulk of the book right here. So that's the Galilean ministry. Now, how many chapters go together as a unit now in the next section? 5, 6, and 7, which deals with Sermon on the Mount. And we group chapters 8 and 9 together, which deal with miracles and discipleship. Here are the miracles grouped together in chapter 8, and then here is the principle of discipleship in chapter 9. All right, here's chapter 10. This is where we'll be for a little while in our study this morning. Chapter 10. So let's go to question number 1. What's the main point of chapter 10? All right, choosing the apostles and sending them forth. And he sends them forth on what? On this commission that we refer to as the limited commission, as opposed to the Great Commission. Great Commission was to all the world. This one was to Israel, the lost sheep of the house of Israel. All right, more about that in a second. So chapter 10, I simply call the apostles chosen and limited commission. So he chooses his apostles. By the way, Luke's account of this in Luke 6 talks about how that Jesus had spent all night praying, and then the first thing that he did as soon as his prayer was over was choose his disciples. Do we know what he prayed about that night? No, not specifically. We're not told. But by implication, it seems to me that he must have done some praying about choosing the disciples. Spends all night praying, and then the next thing that he does is make a great decision. He must have spent some time praying about choosing these disciples. But be that as it may, I'll let you draw that conclusion from Luke 6. All right, let's get another question or two out of the way, and then we'll go into the flow of the chapter. Question number 3. What do we know about the men chosen to be apostles as far as their skills that they had to carry out this job? Say again. Common people. Very good. Yes. Common, ordinary men. They were not skilled men. By that, they were not skilled in the work of that they have been chosen to do. They're not men who have been prepared with school so that they are educated men. That doesn't mean they were not smart men. How do I know that they were smart men, intelligent men? All right. All right, he did that. Peter, James, and John were fishermen. That's not your Saturday fisherman. That was they were commercial businessmen. They had a business of fishing. So they ran a business of fishing. And then you have Matthew, who was a tax collector, an IRS agent, basically. And so you say, well, many of them were dishonest. That's not the question. The question is intelligence. Were these intelligent men? They were very intelligent men. And then later on, the Apostle Paul was schooled at the feet of Gamaliel, would be chosen as an apostle. But these were not educated men, and that's the thing we'll get to in just a moment. All right, question number four. Where were the disciples not to go? Why were the disciples not to go to the Gentiles on this mission? There is some conjecture there. There is some basis on other texts besides this one. All right, very good. What else? Good thought. All right, he told them to go there. And the prophets had foretold about the gospel going to the nation of the Jews first and then to the Gentiles later. We see that in Amos 9 and other texts. So it is a fulfillment basically of prophecy that it was going to go to the Israel first and then later to, and Jesus had said this would be preached first in Jerusalem and then to, et cetera. Make sense? As the apostles were sent forth, even in the Great Commission. We'll say more about that in a moment. All right, let's forego the rest of the questions for the moment and get to the flow of our chapter. Here's what happens in chapter 10. The apostles are chosen and sent. An apostle, the term apostle means one sent forth on a mission. And so here were the men that were chosen. Three things happened there. We'll get back to that. Then we'll see the challenges that they face. And then we're going to talk about the effect of their message. Now what's interesting is this follows on the heels of the statement in chapter 9 that the harvest truly is plentiful and the laborers are few. And then Jesus said, pray the Lord of harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. Do you think that had anything to do with that prayer of Luke 6:12? Maybe so, because as soon as he finished that prayer all night long, then the next thing he did was choose his apostles. That's interesting. You pray the Lord to send forth laborers into the harvest. And he spends all night praying, and then he says, here's the men I want to choose. You make the conclusion, I think it implies that perhaps he prayed about that very thing of Matthew 9 and verse 38. All right. We got some ground to cover, so let's look at the three things that happened under choosing them. The first thing we see at verse 1 is he gave them power to work miracles. Yeah, to work miracles. He gave them power over unclean spirits to cast out and cast them out to heal all kinds of diseases and all kinds of sickness. In other words, you might write out to the margin of your text, as they go forth preaching the message of Christ, they're going to give evidence of their message. Now, there's something practical in that for us. As we go forth telling people, you need to give evidence of the message. Now, the apostles could preach the message and work a miracle. Miracles have ceased. You say, I can't work miracles. No, but you can cite that which has been confirmed by miracles. And so they gave evidence of the message they preached. They didn't do as we often hear people do. Well, we believe, or I think. Give evidence, book, chapter, and verse, for what you believe and what you teach. Make sense? So they're giving evidence by the miracles. That's the purpose of miracles, was to confirm the message, Hebrews 2, verse 4. Now let's talk about the names of the apostles found in verses 2 to 4. We don't know a great deal about each of these men. Obviously, there's some we know more about than others. For example, Judas, or Peter, or John. We know more about them than we do, say, for example, Bartholomew, or Thaddeus. We don't know a great deal about some of these men. These were untrained, unskilled men from the standpoint of the work that they did. Now, there's something practical in that. You say, well, I haven't got formal training in communication, so I can't be effective in the gospel. Here were men who are untrained, and yet they were very effective in communicating the gospel. So can we be as well. Now, let's work through the list. Here's Peter, Andrew, James, and John. They were all businessmen in the field of fishing. We see more about that in Luke 5, if you care to take a look at that. There's Philip. Now, Bartholomew, I said we don't know a lot more about him. Many think, and you might make a marginal note to this, that Bartholomew is the same as the Nathanael that's mentioned in John 1. Can I prove that? No. But because of the sequence of the names, as we parallel John 1 to this, many think that he perhaps is the same man. Is he? I don't know. Perhaps. I'll leave it at that. Then there is Matthew. There's Thomas and there's Matthew, the tax collector. We've already been introduced to Matthew being called. He's also referred to as Levi in Luke's account of that, and Mark's account. But there's James, the son of Alphaeus, thought to be the brother of Matthew because of Mark 2's account. Mark 2 identifies Luke, let me start over. Mark 2 in verse 14 identifies Matthew as Levi, that was his other name, the son of Alphaeus. And so we assume that Alphaeus is the same man here. So am I 100% sure that was his brother? No, but it's very likely. And so we have Peter and Andrew's being brothers. We have James and John being brothers. And perhaps Matthew and James as being brothers. And so perhaps three sets of brothers that made up the disciples. Then there's Thaddeus. And then there is Simon and Judas Iscariot. Now, we could spend time on each one of those, and that would then forbid us to get any further. I just want you to see the names of the apostles, and we know very little about many of them. What we know about Peter, for example, is going to be learned elsewhere. We're not introduced much about him right here, other than he was chosen to be a disciple while he was fishing. All right, now let's talk about them being sent on the limited commission. What do you see in 5 to 15? About this limited commission. Packed full of information right here. All right. Go proclaim the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Now that's what Jesus himself had preached. That's what John had been preaching. That's what they're to go forth and preach. Mark's account, Mark 6:7, said they went out two by two. Matthew doesn't tell us that. So they're sending them out two by two. They're to go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. There's a practical thing. Go home first in preaching the gospel. Start where you are with your family, your friends, people around you. That's something very practical to learn. He also went to those that didn't think they were lost. You know, somebody that thinks they're lost and they recognize, you know what, I'm lost and I need the gospel. They may hear that, but some of the ones that don't want to hear it are those that think they are not lost. And they needed to hear this message first. And so he sends them to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Now, verse 8 talks about the miracles that they could perform. Again, connecting that with verse 1. They're going to cleanse the lepers and raise the dead and cast out demons. This phrase, freely have you received, freely give. I take to have reference that this power is not of their own making. In other words, you're not going to go forth and heal the sick because you suddenly have power, but because I gave it to you. And so as I freely give it to you, you freely use that in the dissemination of the gospel. Some suggest that that means that they were not to take their powers and use them for any other purpose. That is, don't take bribes, don't show partiality, don't sell. This is for the confirmation of the message. So I've freely given it to you, you freely use that. Now, what is verse 9 and 10 about? About providing either gold or silver or copper or bags for your journey or two tunics or sandals, etc. What's that about? Okay. The article goes forth in the spirit of humility. Say again.
I almost think it's another lesson in Christ, what he teaches about material things is not what this is about.
All right. These are good thoughts. I'm fishing for something else. Worker is worthy of his hire. I think he's talking about, while all of this is true, what I think he's talking about is as you go forth to preach, don't carry with you everything you think you're going to need. Those that you teach will provide for you. Does that make sense? The laborer is worthy of his hire. That principle is taught in 1 Corinthians 9 and other texts as the apostles would go forth to preach. So don't take with you gold or silver or copper or et cetera, a bag. I don't think he means don't take any money with you at all. I don't think he's saying don't take sandals with you at all. But don't take everything that you think you'll need on this whole journey. That will be provided for you by those that you teach. So you'll be supported by those that you teach, I think is the idea. Now we'll see more about that at verse 11 here. When they were to enter into a city, they were to inquire who was worthy. Now, that has caused some discussion among some that they were to determine who's worthy of receiving the gospel. If that's the case, what would the conclusion be? You go into a city, is anybody here worthy of the gospel? Nobody is worthy of the gospel. I don't think that's what he's talking about. I think what he's talking about is inquire as to whether there are people who are receptive to the message and receptive to hearing the message. It is not dealing with merit or virtue, but those who respond to the message. Is there anybody here that would respond? And those were the people that they would stay with. I think that's implied. Stay there till you go out. So you go into a city, and if people receive the message, then you go to them and you stay with them. You're going to be provided for by them, and then you'll go on your way to another city. Does that make sense? Again, 1 Corinthians 9 would be parallel in later in the New Testament times. Now, what's verse 12 saying? I think we had a question on that. If we didn't, we should have. So let's just assume we did. I don't see that. What does that mean? When you go into a household, greet it. I think that's more than just saying, hey. All right, you wish him well. All right, yeah. I think that.
Not prejudging.
All right.
Not going to go in there with some kind of bias and be hopeful.
All right, they're not going in with that. That's true. I think it seems to have some connection with verse 13. You go into your household and you greet it, and if it is worthy, in other words, if they're receptive to the message, if our interpretation of verse 11 be correct, then let your peace come upon it. It's not a peace in the sense that you're able to pronounce peace upon this, but may your blessings be upon it. May your encouragement be upon it. And then let's take verse 13 in connection with that. Let your peace be upon it, and if it's not worthy, then let your peace return. I take that to be parallel to 2 John 9. In other words, don't continue to have fellowship with people who are rejecting the message. But if they'll accept the message, then you do have fellowship with them. But I want to go back to verse 12 just for a moment. Go into the household and you greet it, which suggests to me, don't be a pain while you're there. If you are obnoxious and a pain to those you're trying to teach, finish my sentence. They won't listen, exactly. You're not going to do any good. So when you go into a household and you find, well, they're receptive, then greet them. Give a blessing of peace upon them. In other words, have fellowship with them and have a peaceful relationship with them. And if they're not receptive, then you move on and go somewhere else. We're going to see more about that at verse 14. Verse 14 and 15, let me get the point first and then we'll come back to the verse. I think his point is here, don't waste your time on unfertile soil. As you're going forth to preach, don't spin your wheels over here on unfertile soil. So he says when you go to a city, what are you going to do if they do not receive the message? Yeah, shake the dust off. And I think that's more of a symbolic thing. You shake your dust off your feet and go on. I don't know that literally meant you literally shake your feet, dust. But in other words, just kind of good riddance to that and move on to where the soil will be productive. Fertile soil somewhere else. Make sense? All right. So he's sending them out. And then he said it would be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city. By the way, as a footnote, verse 15 tells me that judgment hasn't taken place yet. Many think that when we die, and this is a whole different realm I'm about to introduce, but we've dealt with it before, that when a person dies, God judges them at that moment and sends them to heaven or hell. So someone who's already gone on, they're in heaven or they're in hell right now. And the Bible doesn't teach that. Judgment is yet to come because there is yet a judgment. Sodom and Gomorrah is many years before this. And Jesus is pointing to the future from his point. Though Sodom and Gomorrah, those people have been dead for centuries. And it'll be more tolerable in the day of judgment for Sodom and Gomorrah. So their judgment is yet to come. Make sense? We'll see more about that a little later in the context. Now let's move on to 16 to 33. The apostles are chosen and sent forth. They're going to face challenges. Now, Jesus chooses these men and he tells them, this isn't going to be easy, I want to tell you. So the first thing he tells them is, I want you to go forth and I want you to be wise as serpent and harmless as doves. What does that mean?
Use wisdom and
Yeah. Use some wisdom. I want you to be bold and yet humble. Boldness doesn't mean you're abrasive. You don't have to be abrasive in teaching the gospel, but you need to be bold. You go forth and be bold in preaching the gospel, but use some wisdom. Be harmless as doves, but I want you to be as wise as serpents. Use your wisdom as you go forth. And beware that this is going to happen to you. Here's why you need some wisdom. Because they're going to deliver you to the councils and scourge you in the synagogue. No, where you're going to face all kinds of persecution. That's going to serve as testimony. And just a brief comment before we move on about the testimony. I think that's evidence that they're without excuse. When they've rejected the message, they've heard the message, that gives evidence they're without excuse. I want to move on to this verse 19 and 20. What do you learn from 19 and 20? When the apostles would be put on trial, this is not applicable to us, though there is an application we can make. When the apostles were on trial and be asked questions, and when they were put under pressure, good point. Absolutely. Point is that they didn't have to stop and study. If they suddenly arrested me and took me on trial and said, can you defend the message you're teaching? I might say, well, give me just a minute. Let me get my notes together. Let me get my thoughts together. Let me assemble some things so I can deliver a defense. The apostles didn't do that, didn't have to do that, because it would be given in them at that very hour what they would speak. And so notice verse 19. Don't worry about what you'll speak or how you'll speak. The message or the manner in which you're going to deliver it, the words chosen, so the message or the content of the message. Don't worry about that. God's going to give you in that very hour. So notice in verse 20, the Spirit, it is the Spirit of the Father that speaks in you. All right? So it's the Spirit's revelation. Now, what practical thing can I learn? Well, when questioned, when teaching, I'm to point to the Spirit's revelation. Now, the Spirit's not going to reveal it to me so that I speak it without study, but I've got it written down where I can read it and I can understand it. Does that make sense? Very practical. Hopefully we'll get to some practical things here in a moment. Now, he talks about, in verse 20 and 21, 22, there's going to be all kinds of persecution. There'll be we'll deliver brother and father as child, and there's going to be all kind of turmoil that comes. Now, verse 23 is quite interesting. When you are persecuted, flee to another city. Does that seem a little odd?
I think it's part of being wise as a servant. Know when to be elusive, know when to leave.
Yeah. In other words, what I'm learning from that, that is part of that wisdom. And Stephen's right about that. That's part of this wisdom. Fleeing for safety is not a lack of boldness. In other words, being bold doesn't mean you stand there and let them continue to kill you because you're preaching the truth. You may need to move on. In fact, Paul left Thessalonica for the benefit of the Thessalonians to take the pressure off of them. Remember that? He said that's why he left. And so fleeing persecution doesn't mean you're not bold, doesn't mean you're not willing to stand for the truth. That's not caving to the pressure. You're just moving away from the pressure so that you can do some good somewhere else. So flee to another city. And then verse 23, that you will have not gone through all the cities of Israel, I'm paraphrasing the end of verse 23, before the Son of Man comes. I don't think that has reference to the second coming, but it either has reference, and I refer you to Pope's work on this, Kyle Pope's work on this, that it may have reference to his coming in his kingdom and the establishment of the kingdom. So before the kingdom is established, you will not have made it through every city of Israel. I think it more likely refers, and Pope acknowledges that this could be the case, his coming in judgment on Jerusalem. So either way, before the kingdom is established in 33 AD or Jerusalem is destroyed in AD 70, you will not have made it through all these cities. In other words, there's work to do. I think that's the point. There's plenty of places to go. I've sent you out to the house of Israel. Go preach. You won't make it to every place before the Son of Man comes in judgment on Jerusalem or coming in his kingdom. Now, 24, 25, and 26, let's wind this up, this chapter up, or that section of the chapter. We still got more in the chapter. But the point here is that if they persecute the master, they'll persecute you as well. But I'm interested at verse 26. Therefore, do not fear them, for there is nothing covered that will not be revealed or hidden that will not be made known. What is that talking about? There's something in that phrase that should encourage you as you're being persecuted. The things that there's nothing that's covered will not be revealed. Probably has reference to eternity. It may have reference to the revelation. I want to think it has reference to eternity. The things that have not been revealed about eternity will be revealed. In other words, I think looking beyond to eternity to brighter days will encourage you when you're under pressure. And that's true for us, that when you're under pressure and you're being persecuted or you're suffering, to look to brighter days ahead will be an encouragement. So don't worry about what happens, because there's something brighter ahead. The things that have not been revealed will be revealed. Does that make sense? Now, if that's not the case, it may have reference to the revelation. Now, let's move on and talk about how they're to face these persecutions, beginning at verse 27. 27 through 31 says they're to do this without fear. Now, does that mean that you're not going to be afraid when a man's putting a sword to your neck? Or in our case, it may be a gun to your face? No. So what's he saying? All right, yes. That whatever I tell you in the dark, you speak in the light. Don't be afraid. In other words, don't be ashamed of the message. He's going to get to that. But whatever I tell you in secret, you proclaim it on the housetop, and you proclaim it everywhere. And don't fear him that's able to kill the body. They're going to threaten you. Well, don't worry about those that are able. The only thing they can do to you is take the body. They can't destroy your soul. Fear God, who is able to destroy both soul and body. Now, here's an amplification of that. You say, what does it mean to fear God, who's able to destroy both soul and body? Verse 29, 30, and 31. So how does that do that? Well, that God takes, that two sparrows are sold for a copper coin. In other words, they're worthless, and yet not one of them falls to the ground, that the Father doesn't take care of that and take notice of that. And God knows how many hairs you've got on your head. And if God knows those details, do you think he'll not take care of you? You say, well, he let James get killed. Sure. And I know this is hard to swallow, and I've said this before, but I challenge anybody to biblically deny this. Death is not a big deal to God. You say, well, the death of my loved one was. Yeah, it was and is. Mine too. Death's just not a big deal to God, because there's something bigger and better beyond. Does that make sense? And so don't worry about them taking your life. When you recognize God's providential care and that God's in control. Even in my death, God's in control. Does that make sense? All right. Now then, let's get to the confession down here. And I think his point is here, don't be ashamed. I think it is a misuse of the text to quote this verse in the context of he that believe, you know, you need to believe, repent, confess, and be baptized, and cite Matthew 10. Go to Romans 10. Go to Acts 8. This is not talking about a one-time confession where you acknowledge Jesus is the Christ. This is a manner of life. This is something you do all of your life. And I think the point here that Jesus is making is if you confess and acknowledge him before men, he'll acknowledge you. If you deny him, he'll deny you. So the point here in this context, go forth preaching the gospel. Don't be ashamed of it. If you deny me, then I'm done with you. If you'll confess me before men and acknowledge me in the presence of men and don't be ashamed of me, then I'll acknowledge you. Does that make sense? That's the point. Enduring persecution, exactly. Now then, let's talk about the effect of the message. We've got to get through here. Let's see if we can get 34 to 42. What kind of impact is this message going to have? You're going to go forth and preach. And can you imagine these guys being chosen and they're listening? Okay, we'd like to preach your message. And it may be hard enough if we go forth and you just preach a message and people accept it and some reject it, but what's it going to happen with this message? Absolutely. It's going to cause all kind of turmoil. It's going to turn the world upside down. In fact, it's going to bring division in families. Father against mother and, father against, let me get the wording here at verse 35. That a son of man against his father, and a daughter against his mother, and a daughter-in-law against a mother-in-law, and a man's foes are they of his own household. It's going to tear families apart. You say, yeah, I've experienced that. Some of you have. Yeah, it's going to tear families apart. It may tear marriages up. It may tear children and parents apart. This is the nature of the message. It's going to tear people apart. And it's going to require dedication. He that loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. You've got to love the Lord more than you love family. And it requires taking up your cross and following after him. Now let's get to 40 and 41 and 42. The point here is those that receive the apostles receive Christ. So as you go forth to preach, here's the impact of it. If they receive you, they're accepting me. If they reject you, they're rejecting me. If they reject me, they reject the Father. Make sense? There's a couple of phrases we need to pay attention to. And these are a little awkward because we don't see these elsewhere that I know of. Maybe, but I don't remember. Verse 41, the one who receives a righteous man in the name of a righteous man, and those who receive a disciple in the name of a disciple. That's a Hebraism, which is an expression that means as a prophet or as a disciple. The New International Revised Standard on the disciple says it means because he's a disciple. In other words, those who receive a righteous person because he is righteous, and those who receive a disciple because he is a disciple are those that are receiving Christ. That's the point. It's a Hebraism. It's an expression and a phrase that means not by the authority of the prophet or by the authority of the disciple. That doesn't seem to flow here, but you receive a disciple because he is a disciple. In other words, we do that. When we're convinced someone is a disciple of the Lord and they want to identify and be a part of the group, we accept them because they are a disciple. Does that make sense? To reject a disciple would be to reject Christ. To accept a disciple is to accept Christ. Making sense? All right. Let's move further now. Let's go to chapter 11 now. Now, chapter 11 is John sends messengers, and there's the invitation. So we've got just a few minutes. We want to go through this section about John. The invitation we're more familiar with, so let's see if we can make it through this section about John. There are two things that happen with John in verses 1 to 19. There's the confirmation sent to John, and then there's the commendation of John. This is powerful, this confirmation sent to John. John, the Baptist, is now in prison. He sends two of his disciples to Jesus and asks the question. Luke's account perhaps is a little more insightful to this. But sends two disciples and ask him, are you the coming one or do we look for another? I don't think John is asking for his own information. I know that because John 1 said he had already identified the one upon whom he saw the Spirit descending was the Son of God. He knew who he was. He's trying to get his disciples to see. And what's interesting, this is a powerful point. You need to get this point because this applies to Matthew 19 and other texts. I mean, get the point, then we'll come back how it fits the text. Sometimes God doesn't give us a direct answer. He gives us evidence from which to draw our conclusion. I'll say that again. I want you to get that point. Sometimes God doesn't give us a specific answer. He gives us evidence from which to draw our conclusion. Here's the point. John sends his two disciples, are you the coming one or do you look for another? And Jesus' answer was, go and tell him the things that you hear and see. He didn't say, yes, I am the coming one, or no, I'm not. Yeah, go tell him I am. So they go back and tell, yeah, he said he was. Well, what proof? Well, he just said he was. No, he didn't say he was. Go tell him what you see and hear. Well, what kind of things? Like the lame walk and the lepers are cleansed and the deaf hear and the dead are raised? Are you the coming one? Miracle, 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 miracle. You draw the conclusion. He is. Same thing happens in Matthew 19. Jesus was asked, can a man divorce his wife just for any cause? He never answered that question specifically. What he did was, have you not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave. He gave them four reasons from which to draw the conclusion. Never answered the question directly. So sometimes you say, well, why didn't God say X is a sin? He gave you abundant evidence from which to draw the conclusion. Make sense? All right. God expects us to reason through the evidence. All right, now with that in mind, let's start with the commendation of John. He starts off saying, what were you expecting? I'm going to paraphrase in interest of time. What were you looking for in John? Were you looking for a reed shaken in a wind? That's something uncertain. Were you looking for something that just kind of goes with, and that wasn't John. That's not John. John was not a reed shaken in a wind. Were you looking for a prophet? Let me tell you, he's more than a prophet because he is one about the whom the prophet spoke, Isaiah 40. He quotes that. So what were you looking for in John? Well, he said, look at verse 11. Those born of women, there's not one risen greater than John the Baptist. No one is greater than John the Baptist. But the one who's in the kingdom of Christ, I'm paraphrasing, is greater than John. That's you. That's you. How could you be greater than John? Say again. You're in the kingdom. John never was in the kingdom. Does that make sense? See, John was talking about the coming of the kingdom and never lived to see it and never got to be in it. And I'm in the kingdom he talked about. So in that sense, I'm greater than John the Baptist. All right? Now with that in mind, I want to talk about a couple of other phrases before we get through here. Look at verse 12, that since the days of John the Baptist, the kingdom of God has suffered violence. And I think that's just the people are pressing to get into the kingdom. There was a prophecy of the coming of the kingdom and people are pressing to get into it. That's the idea of it suffering violence. Now, let's go on down to verse 17 and 18. Verses 16, 17, 18, 19. Here's the point. And then we'll be through. John came and people were not happy with John. And he alludes to a children's game. It seems to be a children's game where kids would stand across the street from one another, across the field from one another, and this group over here would play a flute, and the others were, if they wanted to play that game, they'd respond by dancing. And if they didn't do that, well, then this side over here may cry, and the other side would also cry in response. And he said, we played the flute, and you didn't dance, and we cried, and you didn't mourn. In other words, nothing we did would please you. So can you imagine two kids trying to play? Here's a ball. You want to play ball? No, I don't want to do that. Okay, here's a bike. You want to ride bikes? No, I don't want to do that. All right, here's a video game. You want to do that? No. Here's books. You want to read that? No. Well, then you can't be pleased. John came, and he didn't mingle among the people eating and drinking, and they said, he's crazy. He's got a demon. Okay? So Jesus comes, and he mingles among the people, and he eats and drinks, and they said, he's a glutton and a wine bibber. He can't be pleased. Sounds like modern-day press, doesn't it? No matter what you do, it's going to be the wrong thing. Well, that was the way it was with... So now I want us to get down to verse 19, and we'll have to stop. But wisdom is justified by her children. I think that's a vindication of God's wisdom. Wisdom is justified in its children. Wisdom that God uses in choosing John is vindicated in the results you got. Does that make sense? And its offspring. So I don't know about you, but if I were sitting there, and I don't mean to be disrespectful to deity by saying this, if I was sitting beside God, advising God, when he chose John, I'd think, really? Man in camel's hair? Do you know he eats locusts? And you're going to send him out? It worked. It worked. How do I know it worked? Wisdom is vindicated by its children. Make sense? Does that make sense? It works. God's plan works. All right. For one quick reference, the cities mentioned right here in verses 20 to 24, Jesus rebukes these impenitent cities. They are right in the northern part. That's where he is in Galilee. And then we're all familiar with the invitation section where he extends the invitation to come to me, all you that labor. We don't have time to deal with that, but we got through the bulk of the two chapters.